Hello, and thanks for joining us. I'm Carol Jenkins, and the podcast is Black America on the Brink. We take a look at the issues facing Black America and what we need to do to make the best of it. It's an extension of our award-winning CUNY TV program, Black America. Our guest in a moment. Amy Allison is president of Democracy in Color, a national media organization focused on race, politics, and the new American majority. We're going to talk about that. As host of the acclaimed Democracy in Color podcast, Amy explores critical issues at the intersection of race and politics. Ellen McGirt, editor of Fortune magazine's Race Ahead, calls it the smartest podcast on race I've found in ages. Listen and grow. Hey, we're so happy to have you on our podcast, Amy.
Thank you for having me here, Carol. I appreciate you.
So people who want to hear that could just go to democracyincolor.org.
Yeah, .com and or on iTunes.
Yes. Yeah. And so you became president. You have a somewhat famous founder of the organization.
Yeah, Steve Phillips.
So tell us a little bit about Steve. Brown is the new white,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, people should know, first of all, I've known Steve Phillips, who wrote the book Brown is a New White. It's a bestseller, came out last year. I've known him since I was 17.
Is that right?
I went to college. He's like, you know, he's next generation student, like 4 years older. I was a 17-year-old who had just gotten out of boot camp.
Yes.
And I was a reservist.
That's right. Interesting.
Yeah.
And I had just, career.
Right.
Yes.
So I was a reservist. And
right.
So I did something called split training. I had just come from South Carolina, my first experience in the South at Fort Jackson. And so here I was, this very sort of naive. I'd come through military training, but didn't really have my grasp on what I felt like I was supposed to be doing in the world. And then here's Steve, who's organizing. One of the things that he was doing is something like called People's Party, which was this multiracial progressive group of students that I fell into and ran for student senate and eventually student body president. But Steve was organizing. He organized this group of students to go to the South, and he called it Project Democracy. So about 20 of us, we went to Selma. The famous site, the protests at the Edmund Pettus Bridge.
Sure.
We went to Mississippi. We saw the Confederate flag flying over the Capitol. We went to North Carolina. We actually sat down in the homes of the greats, the civil rights. A lot of hidden figures are the ones that we don't read about in the history books who were so instrumental in the success of the civil rights movement and could tell us firsthand. So I was introduced to that world and ultimately to who I became in the world through my friendship with Steve. He was organizing students later for Jesse Jackson. We know the Rainbow Coalition.
Sure.
I was one of those volunteers in California. And I wouldn't have guessed way back in 1987, 88, 89, when I was an undergraduate, that I would actually be doing multiracial progressive politics for reals. And it has now that, you know, 30 years of not only political organizing and, you know, kind of advocacy and being a candidate and working with candidates and being an activist, that through all of this is really a commitment to a vision of the country or in a politic we have not yet seen. And you know, I'm sitting here in your beautiful studio in the CUNY Graduate Center, my first time here in New York.
Welcome.
Thank you. Pretty awesome here. And I'm at this place where I'm like, we are in real danger. Not just black people in this country are in real danger. And so I had that sense that all that preparation was for now.
And Steve brought you there.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that danger. This is a limited series podcast. We do a TV show called Black America, which is more personal profile of people's lives. We talk about issues. But I felt, too, that we were at a particular point, and we call this Black America on the Brink. And I always say, I never say on a disastrous brink. It might be a sensational brink, but you seem to think that it's a dangerous brink that we're on now.
Yes. When I listen to Dr. William Barber, for example, founder of Moral Mondays, and he describes, hey, this is not the worst that we've seen as a community. I think back to, I was a history major in college, as I was thinking about college. I studied the Reconstruction era. Reconstruction was about a vision of opening up democracy and economic opportunity to a whole millions of people that had been enslaved and abused for centuries. And the black people who were able to be elected in state legislatures and Senate, people who were able to set up Wall Streets and communities and have properties and things like that, that was a great vision. But racism and racists were never satisfied with allowing the expansion of democracy after the Civil War starting in like 1865. Now, why am I talking about something so old?
Because it's here again.
Because because the reaction, yes. The racists, they didn't sit quietly as they didn't when Obama was president. They didn't sit quietly while African Americans were asserting a fundamental citizenship right that the Constitution had promised. They organized. They lynched. They ultimately were responsible for a rollback in those fundamental protections. My own family, who lived in what they called Arkansas, which was a territory at the time, my great-grandfather, who had been born into slavery, had a small tract of land and was for the first time economically competing with area farmers. And they didn't even bother having hoods. They came in the middle of the night after federal troops withdrew and threatened his life. And he, as an internal refugee, took his wife and kids, put them on a flatbed, started going north.
Right.
And planned to leave the country as refugees.
Wow.
And ended up in Minnesota. So I am personally, I personally have a legacy where we'd tried to expand democracy and it was taken. So we look at those and then we look at what's going on now. And the way that I understand the danger that we are in as a country is our democracy's on a precipice because like Dr. Barber talks about in this third Reconstruction, he says we're on the, you know, these are the pangs of birth pangs of a new Reconstruction era. We expand democracy to not only black people, but all kinds of categories of the fellow people in this country. And there's a backlash, and it again is led by racists. And it's not just that there's a overwhelming rhetoric that is coming from not only just the White House, but and not just a political party that calls into political unity people who are motivated by race. And it just happens to be the majority of white voters in this country, I'm sorry to say.
Exactly. So you in Democracy in Color have a goal to unite all of the rest of us who don't fit into that, you know, white conservative population. You think that we can take over the country?
We are already, we being this multiracial progressive coalition, we're already the electoral majority in the country. That's how Barack Obama was elected. What we know by looking at the numbers is that if you take the majority of people of color, for African Americans, is a very high percentage, a little less for Asian Americans and a little less for Latinos. But if you take them as an aggregate, plus about 28% of white voters, because there's always been a significant minority of white voters that stand with this, you know, and you put those numbers together, you come up with numbers that can win state legislative, gubernatorial, Senate, the House, presidency. So why do the Democrats lose? This is the part that we who want to expand and change things for good in this country, we know that if we invest in a multiracial coalition, it requires seeing people in a new way. It requires the Democrats, those who are part of the broader progressive movement, to recognize who is in the coalition and whose vote matters and to invest differently and to think of it differently. So Democrats who ignore the power of black women's vote, for example, black votes, they do that, I think, because there's a part of the system that is complicit with the way things are right now. And it would require some deep change in terms of where dollars flow. What are the moral call? It would require Democrats to be much more stronger in defense of people of color in the face of the just outward racist attacks. It would require for Democrats as a political vehicle to do things really, really differently.
And why do you think still they don't? Because even after Alabama and before, you know, when black people came out in extraordinary numbers to save the Democratic Party, there still was no recognition. And I know that we've talked with Higher Heights after, this amazing contribution that black women particularly made in this country, and they couldn't get an appointment, you know, and they got no respect. Why? I mean, Steve says that it's still this search for the white swing vote that they're obsessed
with.
Yeah,
it's just like the obsession. It's a blindness, and it's a blindness caused by both hubris and also racism. It's our job to call it out where we see it. So it's not just the problems over there with the Republicans. The problem is closer to home. When you ask the question why, your question is the answer, because it's nonsensical. Black women, for example, since we as a group have had, you know, regular access to the ballot box only since 65 in the Voting Rights Act, have been the highest or among the highest vote turnout of any race and gender. That it took Alabama, where you had black women as 7% of that state, with remarkable turnout of 98% for the Democrat, and were able to lead a coalition and win a state that hadn't been run by Democrats in 25 years, was a remarkable feat. And that it took that for the DNC and the Democrats to even half acknowledge the powerhouse group that black women are for the Democrats is ridiculous, but it also speaks to a deeper problem of not seeing and not speaking to and not representing and supporting the base and going after swing voters, people who are not likely to show up every time, spending even in Alabama, the irony is Doug Jones, the Democrat who's now the senator, out of $9 million, he spent $7 million on TV ads and digital ads aimed at white swing voters. Alabama was won despite his electoral campaign decisions. And Democracy in Color and a collection of other groups invested in an independent campaign that was run by black women. But it wasn't the traditional moderate white playbook. We see a similar thing lining up in races all over the country. And what we're saying is it's time to stop that. It's time for it's time to really ask, are the Democrats going to respond and support the base? And it has a lot to do with following black women's leadership at this critical time.
And if they don't, that's what are the other options?
It's not even that hard of a question. I pause because I'm like, but, one thing is, you know, will we lose? But when we lose, it's not like, oh, we'll get you next time. When we lose, you know, 900,000 young people who are DACA recipients are deported. People are being rounded up and deported and held in detention centers. People who have been, who are fellow citizens except for paperwork, people who their legal immigration. You know, the stakes are so high for those of us, for people of color and those of us in the black community, that we have to not only sound the alarm, but really demand a very different reality and call out progressives. I'm going to tell you that when we look at the race in Georgia, the gubernatorial race, I don't know if you've been following that.
But of course.
Stacey Abrams is running.
Sure.
She'd be the first black woman governor in the history of the country. So that alone is significant. But she's also a very seasoned legislator who was the top Democrat in the Georgia State House. But even more importantly, as Georgia is almost majority people of color, she founded an organization, is actually running a campaign that expands those and reaches out to the 1.2 million people of color who are eligible in that state but haven't voted. And essentially, that's her strategy to win. And I think that's the Democrats' strategy. But what does the state party do? They run a white, less senior, and very moderate candidate, also named Stacey, who's basically saying we need to go after moderate whites, white swing voters, to win Georgia. Well, that hasn't worked, you know, in over a decade for Democrats in state.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a lot at stake. And if the Democrats do not change the fundamental theory about leadership and what voters matter, it's not just, hey, we need to maximize the black woman's vote. That's not enough. We need people who represent our communities and carry an agenda that will kind of create the country that we want. In order to do that, in races like Stacey, I always say, like, okay, when Wendy Davis declared her gubernatorial candidacy in Texas, when Elizabeth Warren declared herself a Senate candidate, we look at some of these women who have declared. The progressive movement put $40 million behind these women. Well, why not Stacey? Why isn't Stacey getting that level of support, Stacey Abrams? So I'm asking that question. We continue to ask that. Too much to lose.
I'm helping to co-host a fundraiser here in New York for Stacey so that the support that she needs to get from around the country. Do you find that out of Georgia that she is getting some recognition?
Well, Stacey, for 2018, Stacey Abrams' race is a top priority because certainly for Democracy in Color, for what she represents. I launched Get in Formation with Higher Heights and Collective PAC in the summer of last year because she had just gone to her campaign kickoff in Albany, Georgia, which is below. If anyone's from the South, I'm not. I'm from the Bay Area, so we're really weather wimps down there. But it's like hot and steamy, and there's gnats all around. And she was out there with the community launching her candidacy, far, far away from like an urban center of Atlanta. And I think that was really significant because Albany was one of those places that typically statewide campaigns often overlook. It's rural and black. And so these are the kinds of voters that she's reaching out to. But I launched Get in Formation, like Beyonce's Get in Formation.
Right.
Because black women are such the political powerhouses. We're also the unacknowledged fuel behind Barack Obama's, a lot of his success in volunteering and money. So I figure let's get black women across the country aware of and involved in Stacey's campaign. So what I did was I said, I'd launch Get in Formation, but women of many colors came forward and men. So I realized that this is the kind of race where we elevate the profile. And when I say, I met this candidate who's amazing, who's like Barack Obama, amazing, and Stacey Abrams, and get people excited about it, it helps us to see that there's a bright light. I mean, black women, certainly true this year, we are the best hope for this country right now. We can lead.
And you've written a piece for Essence magazine that says, thanks for the thanks, but now.
Right, right. Because you remember after Alabama.
Right.
And I was tweeting, it's like, look at what happened. It was like, oh, how did Alabama do this? Oh, it was the women. No, it wasn't all women. Majority of white women voted for the Republican. It was black women. So then when Tom Perez, head of the DNC, tweeted, okay, let me just say, and this was the first time I know any head of Democratic Party leader to say this, but, black women are the backbone. Then it was hashtag thank black women on Twitter. And I was like, great, thanks for the thanks. Now elect us.
Right.
And it's not just Stacey Abrams. There are amazing black women who are running up and down ballot, state legislators, city councils for Congress that need support.
Tell us about San Francisco.
Well, so I spoke at the Women's March in San Francisco. At the Women's March, my message was, thank black women by electing us. And not only that, elevate our candidates and fully fund black women-led operations like in Alabama. And so that was my message. Then a couple days later, and you know, in San Francisco, Ed Lee was the mayor.
Right.
He was the first
away.
Chinese. Yep. Right. He passed away unexpectedly in office.
Put a black woman.
Right. London Breed.
Right.
Was the president of Board of Supervisors.
Yes. Selected.
So she was the interim mayor.
Right.
Now, when this happened, or remember the Harvey Milk thing? When that happened, Dianne Feinstein stepped into the, she was same. She was president of the board. She stepped into the interim mayor, and then she ran for re-election in the special, and now she's a senator.
Okay, yes.
That's what happened back then.
Yes.
What happened last week was the Board of Supervisors took London Breed out and put in a basically financier, a moderate white guy.
Right.
Who represents the wealthiest part of San Francisco, which is the most expensive city in the country.
Yes. So, and so thanks so much.
Thanks. For... Yeah. So I think and she's going to run in June for the election. But you get if you get kneecapped like that, it makes it very difficult. So the person, Mark Farrell, who's now the interim mayor, has a leg up. And it's important to acknowledge that black women, along with women of color, are the most primary. So there aren't any Republicans in elected office in San Francisco. They're all Democrats. So you have to, when I say people are complicit with a system of racism where you ignore the powerful base, in the wake of the Women's March, where I had speaking to 100,000 people, to mass applause for the idea that we finally follow black women, to have the elected leadership of that city take out the black woman that was leading, who's doing, you know, she's already a seasoned leader, is a slap in the face to the base. And it was people who considered themselves progressive that said, oh, to save our city, there's a political cartoon, to save our city from the rich white men, we had to vote for a rich white man. So this is what we're dealing with.
Sure.
And we have to say with love and fierce love and power, we have to call out the progressives and the Democrats for their role in keeping the staunchest progressives from leadership and power in this country, and ask, like you did, why.
So you went to the march and you spoke. There are a lot of black women who didn't.
Mm-hmm.
I spoke in L.A. In the morning.
Huge. Where, it was a huge. Yeah.
That was a lot of
people.
Ultimately, 600,000 people. But, you know, the activists, you know, were... Those of us, you know, activists, not celebrities, were there in the morning when it was only 250,000 people gathered, and ultimately it was 600,000. The next day I went to Las Vegas for the Power to the Polls event, and Tamika Mallory from the stage addressed the issue of black women refusing to come for one reason or another. And she was very upset, and she said, it breaks my heart, but I can't take it personally. We invited you to participate, and what else can we do? So there are a lot of black women who are not, but you were there. I was there.
I can be there and be the voice. My message was unequivocal. So it's like, I'm like this, I'm here, I'm standing here addressing a majority white woman crowd. There were different people there. I mean, it's Bay Area, it's a different, but it was a majority white women. And I'm telling you that black women should lead. And I got the kind of response. So I was there to be able to deliver a message, a specific message about black women.
But the break, this sort of, I can't say that it's exactly feminist black women break, but it's white women black women break.
But this is something that I know you're familiar with and I'm familiar with in terms of what the women's movement is. We are evolving from a women's movement that's narrowly defined by pay issues and reproductive rights issues to a broad-based justice movement. So I always say we're the women's movement is evolving to a movement of women. And not everyone's going to make that change, because there is a lot of racism in this white feminist idea of white women saying they're the women. And that goes way, way back. And in fact, one thing that I've written and talked a lot about is when Hillary Clinton was running, She never acknowledged Shirley Chisholm, who was the first Democrat woman to run for president. And by not acknowledging her and skipping over and acknowledging the women who were fighting for the right to vote, some of whom were horrible racists, she was missing an opportunity to claim a proud, amazing, powerful legacy of women of color and black women in our country who have done so much to make space for the voices of all women. And the women who were wearing the pink hats in the crowd in San Francisco, Los Angeles, other places, in Las Vegas, who don't understand the need, the centrality of racial justice in the work as women, are missing the opportunity, and they're just not as relevant. So black women have a good reason for saying, hey, I'm not going to be part of that. But what the invitation is, and what I hope Tamika is trying to, we're not inviting you to that. We're inviting you to this new thing that is in creation now. And Carol, I'm telling you, in the last, in the wake of the Me Too movement, mm-hmm. It mattered that it started with black women's voices. It matters that...
Which was hard to recognize,
it was,
you know?
It took, you know...
Tarana Burke really had to fight for a place.
Right, right. And to have that repeated at the Golden Globes by Oprah, it's a powerful, powerful history and story. But if you look at Alabama, it was like the women there... They were like, oh, these women stood up against an accused child molester. That's where that famous story, terrible rape happened in that state. And that's where Rosa Parks cut her teeth on the justice movement that prepared her to lead the Montgomery bus boycott. So it's like racial and social justice and gender justice. This is a new configuration of a movement. It does not resemble white feminist movements. And so you have
any place for them? What's the entry?
Evolve or get out of the way. Evolve or get out of the way. There's always been a significant small percentage of white women who are dedicated to racial justice, for example. And like when I don't know if you went to the women's convention in Detroit.
Yes, I did.
Okay,
yeah,
I was there too.
Yeah.
Okay, at the women's. Okay, so you had the women's march.
Right.
I was in D.C. That was last January.
Right.
The women's convention. When was that? August or?
I believe so. August in Detroit. Right.
So there were all these. So I did a session on She the People and Women of Color in Politics. They were
and that's your book.
That's the book. Yeah,
right.
That's coming out.
Right.
In the end of the year. There's. Much more of an sort of intersectional justice focus for all of these workshops for what was happening on the stage there. And there was also a session for white women. Remember, they did it
yes,
twice.
Right, right.
Because white women who are saying, how do we evolve, have to be intentional and they have to follow the lead of other people.
I thought that was very interesting. An overflow audience, so they had to do it twice. So that was good. The one thing I loved about Detroit is that it wasn't your usual suspects. I mean, some people said, oh, there are no stars here. But what was so fabulous is that it were people who were on the ground doing the work and wanting to learn how to organize. I thought it was just magnificent.
Yeah.
I think the number was like 4,000 or 5,000 people who actually showed up in the end.
Yes. And I think history will show that gathering is more significant than Seneca. And I mean, that was what defined...
That's a statement. I think you may be right.
That defined the modern white feminist movement, right, Seneca?
Right. And you think Detroit defined...
More significant. Because we're entering, I say, you know, we're in the middle of the Me Too era. And when I talk to college age women, I said, you can't believe that even a year ago, if you said someone was abusing you or using their, you know, dominating you at work or something, you wouldn't necessarily be believed. You might, like a lot of us are my age, you might not say something or say something, not be believed. I describe how Anita Hill came. She had the courage. Was a young college professor. She was trying to say, I was abused by this guy. You're thinking of Supreme Court. And the way she was treated by Republicans and Democrats, all men in this Judiciary Committee.
Including Joe Biden.
Including Biden, which, by the way, I have never forgiven. I always remembered from 1991 the way he
talked
to her.
Didn't he recently say that he should apologize? Did he actually apologize?
Or is that, enough already. Right. And don't ask for my vote for president. Right. So I remembered that.
Right.
And so I would we are now at the cusp of a political and cultural era, the dawning of a new age. It is led by women of color. It's led by black women. And the bright, beautiful possibilities that the Women's March invites is this vision of an intersectional policy, a policy, not just policy agenda, but a moral standard for our country that can elevate and bring us into a possible future. So when we talk about that, plus the fact that if we invest and bring in the voters who are most likely, who feel the pain most in this country and are most likely to support that agenda, that's the combination, the potential.
Yeah, but in Las Vegas, they brought in on the stage a slew of women who had either won office or were attempting to win office. And my guess is that every single one of them was a Democrat, you know? So what therein lies that fault line of what happens, you know, if they don't get the support, you know,
No, this is right. And I...
You're not advocating in the Democracy in Color a third party forming something.
No, you should not. I mean, I think we're a two-party system. The Democratic Party is the vehicle for most, certainly black women. There's always going to be the Mia Loves. There's always going to be the Omarosa. So let's not lie. We're not 100% everybody.
But Mia stood up for...
Yes, when they called her country, her family's country of birth, an S-hole, then she finally came
forward. I was glad to see a spark.
Something, a little flame.
A flame.
But because, you know, look at black women vote, 96% for Hillary Clinton, 98%. I mean, we are the most cohesive voting group in the country in terms of, but you're right. Because the vehicle that purportedly is our vehicle to be able to get to elected office is such a broke down vehicle. gas tank's almost empty. Sometimes we're not allowed to take the wheel. It's just there's a lot of problems, and we can call that to account. And then you have the Working Families Party or others. There's a state legislator from New York who was Working Families Party. You had the Green Party. I was in the Green. I left the Democratic Party for a number of years.
I saw that. And you ran for office.
Yeah, I ran for office.
We want you to run again,
right.
You know?
Right. And right now I'm just like, I use my experience to be able to say we have a role, and we support and we work on in a system. But the onus of our power as black women, for sure, we have to find alternate routes to have the money and to elevate, because the same gatekeepers who determine who looks like a leader and who should be leading, those people won't necessarily pick us. So we've got to build our own path to victory.
What has really increased the rage and the fear among I would say Republicans and the conservative whites and the white supremacists and all is that this change in the makeup of our country has already happened. I mean, people keep talking about, well, in 2040, but it's here already.
Yes.
And in reading, you know, Stephen's book, it says that every day, I don't know how many, or 7,000 people of color are born, as opposed to 1,000 of non-people of color. I mean,
it's seven states right now, including my home state, California, New Mexico, and Arizona, and many, many more in the South and Southwest, are almost or currently majority people of color. But our systems are built with such bias, racism built in, including our political system. So just because the population is evolving doesn't necessarily translate to a new set of leaders, although it should in a democracy. So all the policies that we're seeing every day on the Twitter feed, it gives me a stomachache even thinking about it, is trying to make America white again. And this clarion call to racists, to people who don't believe in a multicultural society, who believe, as it was before 1965, that immigration should be limited to Norway and places like that.
I know. I have a friend from Norway who said, please don't blame me.
Right. well, one thing that I always hope that people recognize is that so the largest group is Latinos in terms of people of color in this country. The fastest growing Asian Americans. And one thing that to note is 70% of the Asian Americans who live in the United States were born in another country, but that's evolving and changing.
And have a tremendous wealth, net wealth as well, like 90-something thousand as opposed to the 11,000 that African Americans, because of that immigration.
Yeah,
they
and
come
I think,
here
yeah.
as professionals.
Some do, some. And some don't,
right.
Because the largest, they were, you know, Chinese Americans are among the largest group of poor in California. So we need to learn a lot about other communities of color and their diversity amongst them in order to be prepared for the democracy that they were entering in right now. And one thing that I have progressive friends of many different races who talk about this. But in 1965, when the Voting Rights Act was signed, the compendium law was the Immigration and Naturalization Act that opened up legal paths to immigration to non-white countries. That is the reason that so many Chinese, Indians, Central America can come to this country. Now, what they're trying to do right now from the White House and the Congress is they're trying to go back to the time when it was difficult to immigrate from non-white countries, to try to social engineer the U.S. to be a different, to the electorate, so it'd be majority white country. But that ship has sailed. So the thing for us to understand is we should both be looking at a new set of leaders, and we also need to look at changing the system and the structures. It's a harder and longer term proposition, because it's always good to get behind like an Obama, everyone gets excited. No one elected official can solve the enormity of that problem. We need bigger and more fundamental in order to usher a democracy that's going to work for us in the upcoming age.
There are many who say that the midterms in 2018 could do that.
In what way?
Well, I mean, I think in the way of electing more people of color and women, and women seem to be at the forefront of running for office now. I think thousands, as an Emily, let's say 20,000 women are running.
But here, let me just, can I just speak the truth about something?
Yes.
Okay. It is
That's
wonderful.
What we want, the truth.
I want to tell the truth about, let's just talk about women for a second.
Yes.
There are some remarkable candidates who were standing for office in 2018. The sheer numbers, they dwarf the numbers of people who were so angry about the way Anita Hill was treated in the early 90s that they ran for office. So I was like, if that was a wave back in the 90s, now this is a tsunami. But for white women who are Democrats, they need to understand one essential and very important fact. White women, the majority of them, do not vote for Democrats. So white women running as Democrats can't expect white women to vote for them as Democrats. You know who learned that lesson most painfully? Clinton. But we look at somewhere like California, Barbara Boxer, who was the senator before Kamala Harris became senator for our state, she lost the white woman's vote in her reelection. And I really want that to sink in, because for women, it's women of color, and particularly black women, who empower women of all races to be in office. Why is that important? Because you cannot run as a white woman Democrat candidate and not deal with race, because you will not win. And I just was like, I talk to state ledge candidates, I talk to congressional candidates, and I'm like, we are at a point in our country that we talk about the brink, we're at the brink where racial justice, as well as all these other kinds of intersectional identities and realities of our multifaceted society, those have to be part, front and center of the way that you talk about the issues, things you want to do, and which voter you see. And if you, no matter what your background is, can claim a legacy and deeply identify with different people, which is something Black women do very well. If Black women set the table, everyone's invited, then these are the kinds of candidates we want. If you ignore it, not only aren't you the kind of powerhouse change maker that we need, you also aren't going to win.
Okay. Amy Allison, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
DemocracyandColor.com.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for being with us for Black America on the Brink. Watch our award-winning television show, Black America, on CUNY TV. And thanks to our crew, Executive in Charge, Susan Iger, producers Audra West and Christy St. John, engineers Jack Horowitz and Sarah Fishman. Our music theme is by Tyreek Keys Washington. And we come to you from the radio studios of City University of New York. Let's talk again soon.